As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
I am the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is Rick Miller, lead singer, lead guitarist, and frontman of the long-running band Southern Culture on the Skids, who have been active since 1983. And since then, they've been touring the globe and releasing all sorts of music, albums, singles, 10-inches, box sets. And the latest full-length is At Home with Southern Culture on the Skids. It features a recent coolest song of the world called Run Baby Run, and we'll hear a portion of that now, followed by my chat with Rick on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Run, baby, run, baby, run, baby, run. Run, baby, 'cause here I come. Run, baby, run, baby, run, we gotta run.
Mighty Manfred with you once more for our Coolest Conversations. And my guest today is the lead guitarist and singer in Southern Culture on the Skids, Rick Miller. How are you, Rick?
I am A-OK. How are you, Manfred?
Oh, I am hanging in there, man. I'm hanging in. So, I mean, I think the last time we spoke was like 2017. So a lot of wacky things have been going on since then. Are you still living outside of Chapel Hill, like in Mebane, North Carolina?
No, actually, we moved back into town around 2007.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't.
It has been a while, Manfred. It has. Yeah, we live in Carborough now. But we still own the property out there. We have some, we rent a house, but the studio is still going out there. We didn't really use it on this record too much, but it's still there.
Well, let's talk about that in a moment. First of all, I wanted to ask if your family, friends, were all able to keep healthy over the course of the pandemic.
Yes, they were, actually. We've had pretty good luck, you know, and my wife's a nurse. So the first few months of this whole thing were pretty nerve wracking, and she had to isolate herself from my son and I, pretty much. But we've come through it okay. Everybody's vaccinated and, you know, trying to slowly get things back to normal.
Oh, absolutely, man. I'm with you on that. Before the pandemic hit, so the band, so the Culture on the Skids, wasn't spending as many days on the road as in years back, but touring was still the primary income of the band as a whole, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, of course. I don't think any band that tours and makes records, touring is the only way to make money, really.
Right. So how did you guys get by this past year, not being able to go out on the road?
Well, it was pretty tough, actually. We had a whole year of touring lined up, right? And it just went away in March of 2020, I guess. The one song on the record, Call Me, actually, is about to, I wrote that in the first few weeks of the pandemic, trying to get some unemployment, right? It's the first time we ever applied for unemployment in 30 plus years of playing music as a corporation, you know, as a business entity. That was a shock to the system, I think. But, you know, we had some money. So we always kept some money. The band's always been an equal partner. So we've always had some money in the bank. So we started using that because we had lots of bills to pay. I mean, we still had a van payment. We still had phone bills. We still had, you know, heating and air for the studio and things like that. So, you know, we just had, I'll tell you what we did. We started to make a record too. We did two records, a single and a bunch of videos. I learned how to do, I got a Final Cut Pro. We did a bunch of videos, homemade videos. Mm-hmm. And we knew we had to beef up our presence on the internet. Yeah. And I thought, well, instead of doing live shows and stuff like that, because I didn't really like the live shows. I don't know. It just doesn't translate, you know.
You mean live streams not translating?
Yeah. Well, just the live streams, you know. I'd rather be playing really live. I mean, we may end up doing some stuff like that, but I thought we should go in the direction of writing and recording material now that we're off the road for a good long time. And we were all kind of in our own pod, Dave, Mary, and I.
Yeah.
And I moved the studio gear, what I needed for a record, to my living room. And we made one pretty much the whole record there at home with Southern Culture on the Skids. And then Kudzu Records Presents was a six song box set that we put out a while back. We added six more songs to that, put that out. Mm-hmm. And we did a Christmas song, Surfing on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we stayed busy and we reissued some t-shirts. We did some new t-shirts. We jumped on the cicada craze, right? With Cicada Rock and some cicada t-shirts. Cicada, you know, the Brood, what was it? Brood 9, Brood 10, Brood 11, something like that.
Oh, I can't. 19? No.
Yeah, that was
confusing that. That with COVID-19, maybe. But
yeah, I mean, you're conflating the two. But yeah, don't worry. Like, so we did some cicada t-shirts and we did a t-shirt based on the cover of the new record. And then we reissued some t-shirts. But anyway, all these things kind of kept us afloat, kept us treading water, making enough profits to kind of stay in the black, you know?
Right. Well, you mentioned working on the new album. And first of all, you know, that the studio is still ongoing outside of town there in Medmen, Kudzu Ranch Studios. But you mentioned bringing stuff home to your house and kind of recording in your your living room?
Yeah.
Let me ask about that. So as you were recording, were the three of you guys still separate? I mean, did they all come over to your house at the same time, or were they off recording your parts elsewhere and then sending them to you?
Well, what we did was Mary and I work on most of the stuff together. So Mary would come over and she and I would work on some arrangements and get the song kind of together and maybe do our parts, decide on a tempo. Mm-hmm. And then we get Dave to come over and do the drums. He did some of the drums there. Some of the drums we actually did at the studio. Yeah. Some of them are in my living room, but I have a really good sounding living room. So most of the record was made there. All the guitars, vocals, bass, blah, 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 done in my living room. It's got really high ceilings.
Okay.
And it's an open kind of open floor plan.
Yeah.
And it's all a kind of a obtuse angles on the ceiling and stuff, kind of a cathedral ceiling, but kind of odd. So it's really quite good. The reflections in there are really nice. So we did it. And I think it just added to the theme of the record, right? To do it in my living room. Cause it's I would say kind of a little more relaxed.
Yeah.
It was relaxed when we were recording it, especially with the vocals and things like that, a little more laid back, I guess, I don't know if that's a good word or a bad word, but it was really enjoyable and fun to do. And I mixed it all there and everything.
Well, truly, so, truly is at home with Southern Culture on the Skids.
Oh yeah, you bet, man. I mean, if you listen hard, you can hear the dog bark. You can hear my son tell me to be quiet because he's trying to study, you know, all the things that go with it. Sarah coming home from work going, "Hey, I'm hungry. I want dinner. Where's dinner?" Because I've had to learn how to cook too during this pandemic, man. Right?
Well, you're just a renaissance man. The pandemic has been good to you.
I got to stay busy, man. That's the only way to get through this stuff. Stay busy.
What is the,
you know,
what
that is, man, for
what's the most complicated dish? What was your crowning cooking achievements from
the
pandemic?
You know, I never get too far over my head on that, Manfred, you know. So I was doing this garlic chicken that was pretty good, right? Yeah. And then I got really good at roasting vegetables. Mm-hmm. I've always been a killer bean man, right? I can make some good beans, right? But you know how that is, Manfred. It goes way back. If you're a musician, you appreciate beans.
No beans, no beans.
Yeah, no beans, no food.
No beans on tour. That's the rule. What you guys are doing, just driving the windows down all the time, I guess.
Well, we had to get a bigger van. I don't know what size van you guys are doing. Has to do it. It's just like COVID, man. Airflow and space, right?
Yes, absolutely. Airflow and space.
We've known that for a while.
Let me interrupt for a second. I want to get back on track with some of the songs. So 11 songs on the album. Call that, you mentioned, as being written because of the pandemic, inspired by the pandemic. Were any of the other tunes a result of the pandemic, or these were songs that you already had been working on, or were there other ones that came up during these past months?
Well, some of them we had been working on, like Don't Spill the Java had been around for quite a while. But you know what was funny was I never really thought about any songs being pandemic related other than Call Me. But when I listen to the record as a whole, I can see that somewhere under the surface that it was all kind of working towards that. I mean, like, you know, Sugartown, you know, I got some troubles, but they won't last. You know, Dear Mr. Fantasy, the two covers were somewhat sort of connected.
Let's talk about the covers for a minute. You mentioned that versions of Sugartown, Nancy Sinatra did that originally, and the version of Traffic's Dear Mr. Fantasy. I think Nancy tunes would always be a good fit for Mary, aren't they?
Always.
Yeah.
I still, one of my, on my list to do is a all Mary, a go-go country record. You know what I mean?
You should call it Mary Queen of Scots.
Right. Well, we were going to call it If You Got a Go-Go, Go Country. You know, so those are always a big favorite, and that kind of sassy delivery and stuff Mary's good at. She's she really likes Nancy Sinatra too, as do I. And her arrangements are great too. I like listening to her records because I'm a big fan of Billy Strange, actually.
Okay, yeah, right. Specifically, though, Lee Hazelwood wrote the song. I was wondering, did you ever come across him in your travels? Did you ever meet Lee Hazelwood?
No. And I always kind of wanted to, but we just never got connected. I mean, he had a bit of a renaissance, reawakening there.
Right towards the end.
Yeah. And but we never ever got to meet him or talk to him. I would have loved to have talked to him because he seemed like a real outsider, you know.
I was speaking with the author of, what is it, Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars. It's like The Myth of the California Paradise. The author's Joel Selvin. Yeah, he had this great section on Nancy Sinatra. And the thing about the book was Nancy Sinatra and Janet Dean and this graduating class of like 1958 or 59. But all these Southern California artists, early 60s California artists, were all like not just from the same age group, but like a lot of them actually went to the same high school even. But he talks about Lee Hazelwood and how Hazelwood tries to portray himself as the outsider there in LA at the time, although he'd already been living there for like over 10 years, around 10 years, but he's trying to make it seem like he's the outsider. And there's a great description about him starting to work with Nancy and how he's like, you know, I don't really know if I want to do this. And gets invited over to Frank Sinatra's house, and basically Sinatra makes the decision for him. That's great. And of course, Hazelwood, despite all of his cantankerous, you know, I'm my own man, when the chairman of the board said, welcome aboard, then he just sort of like sucked it up, you know.
But well, you know, a lot of those, they all have a very serious survival instinct. It always helps to have that when you're especially so-called independent, right?
Right. Well, tell me about the Traffic tune, because now that, you know, thinking of you guys doing a Traffic song, that's not in the usual wheelhouse that I think a lot of folks would associate with Southern culture on the skids.
That's kind of why we did it. I always liked the song. I enjoyed the melody and the lyrics and just kind of the vibe of the song. And I thought Mary could sing a killer version of it.
Yeah.
And I always thought, like, just kind of little poke in the ribs there to put a banjo on it. You know, so, you know, there sometimes the covers, you know, you love the songs, but you approach them in a bit of maybe a subversive way. Right. That's always the best way to do covers, in my opinion. It's a lot of work, though, really, because you're kind of reinventing the song to a degree. So it's almost as much work as doing an original. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't get paid as much.
So. Right. Well, you know, and it's interesting, like I'm a big Searchers fan, right? Liverpool band. And, you know, they couldn't write an original song to save their lives, but man, they were really smart about the songs that they would cover and always do great arrangements of.
No, they were, I love listening to the Searchers too.
Well, you've got a healthy number. You've always had a healthy number of instrumentals mixed into your live shows and on your albums. And so the new album's got a couple, Billy's Board and Night Driver. And Billy's Board, sort of a surf tune. It's got a dash of Link Wray tossed in. And I know that Link Wray, an important influence on you. And later on, you got to tour with him. oftentimes it's said it's not good to meet your gods. What was it like, not just meeting Link, but, you know, playing with him on stage?
Oh, it was awesome. Link was great. Link was great. He was such a nice guy. His wife was a little bit dicey sometimes, but once she got to know you, it's like the first time we played with Link Wray was in New York City, and Todd set that up, right? It was Swinging Neck Breakers, us, and then Link Wray.
Right, we're talking about Todd Abramson.
Todd Abramson, that's right. So we tried to meet him then, but we couldn't really get close to him backstage, right? Because his wife was pretty protective of him. I don't know exactly what was going on with all that. When we started playing, of course, we were going to finish with a Link Wray song, of course. And it was like Turnpike USA or something. It was a kind of a rare, obscure one. And I looked over when we were playing, and I saw Link at the side of the stage, man, pumping his fist, right? Go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I thought, oh, that's so cool. And, you know, because he's my all time favorite. And after the show, he goes, he knew my name. So he must have been aware of us. And he said, Rick, man, what was that last song? I said, Link, that was one of yours. It was like Turnpike USA. He goes, damn. He goes, that should have been a hit. But, you know, we played with him in Minnesota, too. That was a great show, too, because it was us, and I believe it was Deke, and I think it was Deke as I think it was Untamed Youth, maybe it was the Echophonics, I can't remember.
Yeah,
and Link Wray, and we all got on stage and played, maybe it's Rumble, I would probably be the one, or Jack the Ripper or something. And I remember I was doing one thing wrong, and he came over and corrected me. But he was really great. I remember asking one time, I said, Link, what's the secret to your longevity? And he goes, Heineken and vitamin C.
But he had the formula right there.
He did. You know, and we played with him on his birthday. We found
what birthday was that? Do you recall?
Oh, God. It was 70 something, I believe.
Okay. All right.
I mean, he was old. Golly, I can't remember. But anyway, we got him a used Dan Electro, one of the reissues, right?
Yeah.
But we got it for him, and we all signed it and gave it to him on his birthday, right? For a birthday gift. So that was pretty cool. I thought I saw a little tear in his eye. I don't know. Yeah, it was really nice. Yeah. It was great.
So I was wondering, was there any bit of, like, did he ever take you aside and give you some sort of bit of advice going forward? I mean, is the Heineken and vitamin C, would that be the advice that he gave you? Or was there anything else that he parted you with?
That was about it. Well, it was hard to get him away from his wife at times. You know what I mean? They were always together.
For people that are listening that aren't aware of this, she was such a unique individual that he would be playing on stage. And at this time, you know, what the hair he had was pulled back in the song Ponytail, and she would physically get up on the stage. And if she didn't like someone in the front of the audience, like he was performing in front of, she would walk over and she would, you know, kind of be dancing a little bit, but really her intent was to grab him by the ponytail, and you could see her just, you know, guide him away from whatever side of the stage that was. So, you know, if, you know, let's say there was some youngish lady down front dancing, his wife did not like that. And she would sort of move him away from them, you know, and it wasn't like he was being lascivious or anything. He's just playing guitar, you know.
I don't know. It could have been a relative, too. I heard she was kind of protective of him, like wondering, you know, of course, this is just gossip. Maybe I shouldn't say it, but because I never saw any of it. But I heard that some of his children from other marriages sometimes would show up at the shows, and she'd like to keep them away from them, too.
I heard the same thing.
So I have no, but I have no idea. Yeah. She was always pretty nice to us. And once we got to know her and Link, we had access when we needed it.
So we've talked about these instrumentals you've got on there. We have not spoken specifically about Run Baby Run. That was our coolest song in the world a couple of months back. And, you know, you are the principal songwriter. Mm-hmm. In my notes, though, mentioned Mary Huff as being listed as a co-writer on that one. Now, you mentioned her coming over and you guys kind of working on arrangements. So tell me specifically about this song, Run Baby Run, and how it came together.
Oh, well, Run Baby Run started out as a whole different song called Don't Listen to Him. But I was listening to some playbacks on it, and I was all of a sudden I just started singing "Run, baby, run, baby, run, baby, run." It just fit, you know. Yeah. And Mary came over, and I played it for her, and I said, "This is kind of a new lyric I think would work." And then she was standing there, and she hit that "Run, baby, run, baby." I was doing that, and she goes, "Run, baby, run." You know how she hits that long note?
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's it. That's a hook, Mary. I said, that's now this song has got to, you know, you've got to sing this song. We've got to do this. So we worked on some lyrics later that day and basically recorded it, and all came together really fast. I mean, you know, some songs take longer. This one took a while as a different song. But then once Mary hit that note, it was like, this is yours, Mary. Come on, let's go.
And so remind me, what did you say? What was the initial title?
The initial title was just called "Don't Listen to Him." And it was just kind of a song about, you know, some guy is trying to lie to you a lot. And, you know, it's like, don't listen to him. He'll only drive us apart kind of thing. But "Run, Baby, Run's" even better. And I thought it was really good, too, because it's all about forward momentum. Right.
Yes.
And kind of getting out. And this is another thing that I thought of after the fact. Right. You know, it's like, wow, where we're at right now or where we were at that time, boy, we couldn't get out of there fast enough. Right.
Absolutely.
So it's all about forward momentum. And I'm really glad that Mary did a nice, powerful vocal on it. You know, it's nice to have a woman's voice singing that. And, you know, I just thought it worked together on a lot of different levels. I thought it was a really good song. And I also loved how much garage was in it, right? We didn't have a real garage-flavored song for this record yet. And this was kind of the cherry on top for me. It's like, okay, record's done. We got the songs now.
Yes. Complete cherry on top. Very delicious. Very tasty. You got the surf instrumental sounds, the rock and sort of garage sounds on tunes like "Run, Baby, Run." Also, you got a lot of number of countryish tunes. What are they? "Let Me Make You Happy," "Where's the Moon," "Everything Grows in a Garden."
Mm-hmm.
This mash kind of influence and stuff. How closely are these sounds, these styles, related to the fact that your mom's from Southern California and your dad is from North Carolina?
Oh, totally, totally. Manfred, I grew up listening to the first some real formative years of my life up till I was about, we moved around a lot because my dad was in the mobile home business. But we stayed the longest when I was in North Carolina from about 6 to 12, and then we moved to California. Of course, my parents separated. He went back to the South. So I was equally divided between, I was a bi-coastal kid. Mm-hmm. But growing up in Henderson is how they say it. North Carolina, the radio station there, my first memories of really listening to music was an AM station. We only had one AM station in town, had to serve a very diverse audience. So there would be, you know, you could hear the Staple Family Singers, you could hear Aretha Franklin, you could hear Buck Owens, you could hear the Yardbirds, you could hear the Dave Clark Five, Herman's Hermits, Cream. I mean, I remember even hearing Blue Cheer on that radio station. And that's what really opened my eyes to rockabilly, because the only song I liked was, I loved Summertime Blues, right? Yeah. And it wasn't until later that I found out, when we moved to California, I had access to some real record stores and stuff, that was an Eddie Cochran song. And that sent me off, you know, in high school, off on a different direction and stuff. But all of those, I think that had a real impact on me, listening and learning that all that music, and it was all good, you know, it was all good. So I think that when it comes to writing songs and having a band and stuff,
yeah,
I think it all kind of goes back to that.
Well, when did you actually start playing guitar?
Well, I started playing guitar when I was still back in Henderson. But I remember I got some guitar lessons, and it was a bunch of folkies. It was like downtown, and my mom had dropped me off. I got really bored really fast because I just didn't want to learn Green Sleeves, right? I wanted to learn Sunshine of Your Love, right? So I remember a few times towards the end there, I would just not even, I'd look like I was going up the stairs to my lesson, but I would just go down to the smoke shop, which was the local pool room with the dirty magazines and all that kind of stuff. I remember I loved those comic books from from Sex to Sexty or something like, I can't remember, but they had all kinds of adult magazines and stuff like that. So that was kind of rock and roll, right?
Well, yeah. Well,
got my priorities straight,
right?
How old
are you? Like 11, 10 or 11?
I was like 11. 11 maybe
I'm sure
just
you didn't call any attention to yourself. It just slipped
in. It was kids in there and stuff too, because it also, I think it had a soda fountain and things like that. It was like a newsstand.
Okay.
Of course, you'd reach for Iron Man, but really you were looking over here.
So that's when you start. And that didn't last, I guess. You set it down.
And no, it didn't. I just kind of learned stuff on my own. Right. I got to California. I got my first guitar in Henderson. I got it at Rose's department store, and it was like a Welltron. It was like a Japanese electric. And then I got my first amp. They wouldn't buy me an amp, though. They said, no, I kind of like this one even better than the acoustic because it's even quieter, right? So when we moved to California, they got me an amplifier, a little Champ, a little Vibro Champ. And I remember just turning that up and experimenting with feedback and stuff, just stupid stuff in your bedroom, when you're 12, 13 years old. But I was never really in a band. I was in the motorcycles in junior high and high school. I used to race motocross, but I always kind of played guitar, and I had friends that played guitar. They show me chords here and there and stuff, but I didn't form a band until I got to move back to North Carolina to go to grad school. And that's where we started it. My roommate was, he had a band, and we wanted to do some sort of a rootsy kind of a progressive rootsy thing. That's where the band started, really. First practices with the art lab at UNC Chapel Hill.
So wait a minute, you said when you moved to North Carolina to go to graduate school. Is that
yes.
What you said?
Yeah.
Oh, so it wasn't undergrad. So what did you go to graduate school in?
It was painting and printmaking. I got an MFA in painting.
Oh, I didn't realize that. A master of fine arts.
Yeah, I used to do all our posters and stuff, but I still have a lot to do with some of the design stuff. But yeah.
And so with this other guy, when you started that became the beginnings of what became Southern Culture on the Skids.
Yeah, that started about 1983. Everybody just kind of slowly drifted away from that band. Mary joined in 1987.
Yeah.
And then Dave joined in 88, but Dave and Mary grew up in the same town, Roanoke, Virginia. They played in a lot of like rock cover bands and stuff like that. Mary was a cello major actually at VCU in Richmond when she dropped out to join the band in 87. And Dave actually is quite educated too. He's got an MFA in music education from Harrison up in Harrisonburg, Virginia, James Madison University, I believe, and an undergrad from Virginia Tech.
So when I first saw the band, it was before Mary and Dave had joined, and it was at the Uptown Lounge in Athens, Georgia. I enjoyed it enough, really enjoyed it actually, that the student radio station that I worked at the time, 90.5 FM, they had that first album. I'm not even sure if it's how many tracks are on that LP?
It's like nine tracks.
Nine tracks, right. And I had heard it before and, didn't catch my ear at that point. But then I went back to it and I listened and I thought, those guys are definitely better live than this.
Well, yeah.
Honestly, and then it seems like a couple of years went by and you guys were playing at the Downstairs, this place in Athens, Georgia, where you had the tiny little place and you had to walk and go, it was down, below the street. And I was stunned when I came, I went with this, my date was Karen Goodchild, lovely lady, and nice name too, Goodchild. And we went in there and I was saying, there's three of them. I wonder when the rest of the band is going to show up. And then you started playing and completely different. It was a completely different thing. I was just completely blown away as well. I mean, it was phenomenal. All the songs were really great. And at that point, there was no eight-piece box, but you were riding on that guitar. What's the song where you sing about, I've got five fingers on?
Clyde's Lament.
Yeah. So that, and it was just like, wow, this is phenomenal. And so that then must have been 1988 because Dave was on drums, man.
Yeah.
And you've had those two with you now for God. That's a good stretch.
It is a good stretch. Well, I mean, I don't know. We all get along. We each have our own van seat. That's the secret, I think, to keep it a three piece. Everybody gets their own van seat, right?
That's right. That's why you can eat the beans, I guess.
That's right. Well, that's what I'm saying. We've been ahead of the curve here with you know what I mean? Spatial distancing and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about shows, but here this is going to tie into something here. So I was looking online and it says you have a gig scheduled for next month, September the 11th. Mm-hmm. Something about the Outback Opry Drive-In. What is that?
Well, there won't be steaks and blooming onions, but it's a WNCW is a radio station up in Spindale. And they are very supportive of us. And they've been doing shows there at their local cultural center, which I believe is called the Foundation. They've been doing when they call it out back, it's literally out back in the parking lot of the venue.
I see.
We've never played there before. So this, I'm kind of reading this offline at the same place. I probably got my information the same place you did. But it's a great radio station, and I'm really happy that we're going to be able to play there. It's going to be one of those drive-in shows where you pay for cars to come and stuff. It's outside, so I feel relatively good about all that. And it comes at a good time, too. We could use a little bit of money. So,
September 11th is the date, and then, I'm mentioning that again because your album, At Home with Southern Culture on the Skids, that will be available sometime in September as a proper, as an LP, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's been sort of a staggered release, but walk me through this. Album was available originally several months back. You could get it directly from you guys.
That's correct.
Now by September, it should be in retailers or what's the story?
Yes, we'll have all formats available September 10th and CDs available in brick and mortar stores or, you know, online at Amazon. We'll also have, I believe, digital downloads you could probably purchase right now. I'm not positive on Amazon, iTunes, you know, all the stores, all the digital stores. But September 10th will be available in all retail stores in all forms.
So that the Outback Opry Drive-In is kind of like your record release party then.
It is. It will be, yes.
So now that show is outside, and checking out your website, you had some other shows listed for December. Do you think you'll be adding any more this year, or are you more focused on touring for 2022?
You know, it's kind of tough. We had a whole full fall schedule. But we had, you know what it's like, Manfred, you have to confirm this stuff so far in advance that a lot of these things were starting to get, you know, needed confirmation on way back in like January of this year, even some in December. And we just didn't have the guidance. We didn't know what to do. So we just, we told Botch over Billions and Christine to just move them all to 2022, fall of 2022. And they thought that was a pretty good idea too. And I guess with this Delta variant, it's not a bad, not, it kind of maybe worked out. I doubt we'll be scheduling any more shows in the fall. We have some local North Carolina shows in December, and then pretty much a full touring schedule starting in January of 2022. And we'll just have to take that as it comes, I guess. Right.
Right.
Well, it's still very hard to figure out exactly what's going on with some of this stuff. I don't know about you, Manfred, but you know what I mean, with the vaccinations, mandates, you know, I mean, I want everybody to be safe, but I don't know. There's no overall plan, especially when it comes to small clubs and stuff.
Well, the new album opens up with the song Call Me. And we sort of talked about that a little bit already. That was a result of the pandemic lyrics in there about no toilet paper on the shelf.
That's a true story. You know,
I was going to ask you, were you ever low on the TP? So it's true.
We were. Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me? And no garlic. I mean, come on. You know, and no bananas. I was like, but lucky for us. Okay. It was at one time that it really came in handy to be somewhat of a local celebrity, because we had a really big fan that worked at our local Harris Teeter, which is our grocery store chain here, right? Kind of like Vons out there, right?
Yeah.
And I came in and I said, God, no bananas, no garlic, no toilet paper. He goes, don't worry, Rick, I'll text you when the trucks are coming.
Oh, man.
So I had my inside operator, man, and he was a big fan. So it worked out. That was one time I go, wow, I'm lucky to have some, to be in the business.
Also in that song, there's a shopping in pajamas thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have to say, just so the people in satellite radio listening land know, that I have seen Rick Miller in pajamas.
Yeah,
they're very nice pajamas. You have some very nice pajamas. I've seen you in more than just one style. But the problem is, I can't recall whether I've seen you in your PJs just at your house or whether
we played a show
on the road and somewhere saw you like coming out of a hotel or something in PJs. Do you take PJs with you, pajamas with you when you're on tour?
I do.
Rick Miller, why are pajamas a necessary part of any touring man's pack?
One, it's like it keeps you from getting rashes from sleeping in your sweaty clothes that you just played in, because that's the other option. So, but other than that, it's kind of nice because it resets everything, right?
Yeah.
You get back to the hotel or where, whoever you're staying with, to their house, you go in the bathroom, you know, you brush your teeth, take a shower, you put on your pajamas, boom, hit the restart button. And then it's kind of easier to go to sleep too. You know, it just kind of starts the process.
Yeah.
So I'm all into that. And if you have decent looking pajamas, I mean, you can get away with walking in public with them, right? Because they kind of look like pants these days.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So what? So flannel, silk, what kind of pajamas are you wearing?
No. All cotton all the time. Flannel in the winter, light cotton in the summer. I have a pair of really nice polka dot pajamas right now that my wife gets me. She's a big pajama fan, and she doesn't like to see me walking out in public in like lousy looking pajamas. Well, she doesn't like to see me in public in pajamas anyway, but sometimes it happens. So yeah. I always can depend on a new pair of pajamas for my birthday and Christmas. Right.
Oh, how nice.
Which happened to be in the summer and the winter.
So the polka dot ones, are they the most recent?
They are the most recent. I don't have them on now. I actually changed into pants to talk to you, but I didn't need to though. I did it out of respect, man.
I'm so flattered. Rick Miller, thank you again for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Good to talk to you, man. For it's been too long.
Yeah, as always. In fact, you know what? We were talking about the track Call Me most recently. So let's go out with that.
Okay.
Call Me, the opening track to the new album from Southern Culture on the Skids called At Home with Southern Culture on the Skids. Call Me and Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Call me, won't you pick up the phone and call me? I'm all alone just sitting at home. Won't you pick up the phone and call? The weather is warm, but I'm filling out forms, staring at a computer screen. The sites keep on crashing, the bad news keeps blasting. You know I can use some relief. So call me, call me, pick up the phone and call.
Southern Culture on the Skids with Call Me here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. The track is off the band's latest album, At Home with Southern Culture on the Skids, and it's available from Kudzu Records, and that's the band's label. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to their frontman, Rick Miller, for joining me today. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our interview. And join me next time around where we'll check in with singer-songwriter Willie Nile. We'll be talking to him about his new album, The Day the Earth Stood Still. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Don't let it be fine, baby, diamond ring.